Okay, this is going to be fun tonight if my voice holds out. So we'll see how well it goes. But it's a fun topic, web characters. There were a couple of questions last time in the various points. Thank you, by the way, to Yejun for teaching the class. Are these the most fun students you've ever worked with? Better than your other class?
I wouldn't say that.
One of the questions last time, I think it was by Elizabeth, was how do you save the damn thing when you're using Google Documents?
How do you get back out?
Yeah, okay.
And someone sent an email around saying that they
now. Last night at 2 in the morning, I was like, there's got to be a way. So between 2 and 3 in the morning, it's just in the help thing.
It was a great question.
Okay, so the muddiest point of today's class was empowering members of an online community over time, according to one person. Now, it's the smallest number of muddiest points I've ever received. So is it the other people are confused, or did somebody get lost on the way, or what? Other people weren't confused. Other people didn't put in money as well. That is a wonderful question. It's a question people are still doing research on. It's a question people will likely do research on for quite some time. I just came from a National Science Foundation panel where we're reviewing proposals for research on information science. And questions like this are very much on people's minds. The one thing I'll say about that one is, you came to the right school, because this is what our dean says. So the course 708P, I think, OESP 708P, Communities of Practice, was developed by Dean Priest specifically to address questions like this. How do you create healthy communities? Because it's really easy to build this technology, right? All the pieces are there. But it's really complex to think about how to use it. Anyway, so I encourage you to consider taking that course if you find that area interesting. Somebody sent a great email while I was still down in Tampa that said, it's so charged up, I couldn't stop thinking about online communities. I felt really bad for not responding because I was in the midst of a set of other meetings and then it escaped into my backlog. But it sort of gave me a feel for what it would have been like to sit here talking to you about it. I want you at the end of today to be just as charged up about the web in your life. It's very old. It's not like online community. So I'm going to try to convince you otherwise. Questions first? Okay. So we already had a class on the web, right? It was like, HTML and HTTP and URL and UCWeb, right? And then we had a better class on the web where we did like JavaScript. And then an even better class on the web where we connected a database to the web, right? So, we've done the web lots of different ways. So the idea now is all the technology gets put in place. And then we get the world's largest online community. All the people putting stuff on the web and using stuff on the web, right? It's an online community. It behaves like a community with lots of sub-communities. So what is this? So we're not so much after the technology of the web now. We're after how people use that technology to do things. We want to understand sort of what this living organism, this multi-intelligence organism, is. So the web is, in one sense, just a way of moving ideas between people. And so we'll spend time thinking about what the consequences of being able to do it the way the world itself are. So I first want to talk about why is there a world like that? Now, this probably strikes you as a silly question. I mean, there is a worldwide web, right? It doesn't mean why. But there was a time when there wasn't a World Wide Web. So there must be some why. There must be some reason why the web came into existence. Now, the web came into existence sometime between 1992 and 1995. And if you look at what happened along that period, you'll find all sorts of precursors getting put into place before 92 that make it possible to get started on something, and then you'll find that things essentially get to scale around 95. So it's interesting to study how that beginning occurred. But what I want to do now is I want to sort of snapshot into 95 and say, okay, now that everything's in place, what was that set of things that had to be put into place for the web to come into existence? And so, here's the first one. Now, I know you guys hate the map. I mean, you've been very frank with me on it. But the map is really useful for understanding why the web exists. Because this is its number. I mean, if you think about it, what is the web? The web is an ability for me to see information that you have stored on your computer using the web, right? Well, storage is expensive. Why would you store something for me on your computer? But if storage is cheap, you're not going to care, right? So this doesn't cause you to want to store it, but it does remove the thing that will keep you from wanting to store it. Now, disk prices got cheaper during this time frame, and they continue to get cheaper after this time frame. And in 1995, if you go plot the disk price curves, you could buy a large enough disk to hold 300,000 words, or 6 bytes per word, for about $1. Right? So $1's worth of disk would hold, that's about 10 books. Now, if I could only hold a tenth of a book on my disk for $1, you might think, hey, I might get paid $1 for that web page. But gosh, I mean, if I could hold 10 books on there for $1, you might think, oh gosh, am I going to get paid a penny for the web? I mean, there's some point below which I don't care. That point is somewhere around here. So before this, disk prices had just been way too expensive for everybody to use it. This stuff has been used in government laboratories for quite a long time before that. But it was very expensive. So what happened was the disk price part of this alone by 1995 was cheap enough. I didn't really care anymore. So, it doesn't do me any good. Don't worry about what protocol we use. But it doesn't do me any good to have store stuff that you can use if I have no way to get it to you. So until we have a network, we weren't going to have a web. I mean, getting a network wasn't enough to have a web, and to have content and lots of other things. But until we had a network, we sure weren't going to have a web. Now, how fast does the network have to be? Well, if the network in the United States as a whole could support the transmission of one web page every hour, there wasn't going to be the web, right? But if it could support the transmission of a billion web pages every millisecond, well, then you know the web wasn't going to use up very much of the network. So you can look and see how fast the network was then. And what you can do is you can like pick up a typical size for a web page. Maybe it's 2,000 characters. And then you can ask the question, how many simultaneous 2,000 character transfers could I have going on at one time? That's essentially how many clicks can I support, right? So that answer turns out in 1995 to be 25,000. Well, if that number were 3, we weren't going to have a web. If the number was 25 billion, well, we sure have one. 25,000 turned out to be enough. Was this a limiting factor? I don't know. But this is where these two things were about that time. Now that's the backbone network, the network that goes between the routers But what about getting to your house? Now, back in this time, people didn't have broadband to their house. So people would do things like, I mean, I remember doing this when I was a grad student. I finished my PhD in 1996, so this is very much my era. People do things like drive to school in order to download a file and then drive home and use the file, right? Where the file would sit at school. Because the speed for home connection was very unreliable. Anybody here ever connect through their cell phone to the internet? You kind of get a feel for what it was like back then. It's pretty slow. It drops a lot, right? Has to be rebooted a lot. So that what they're doing is they're making faster and faster modems. And that's when they got to the point where they could send you an entire screen full of text in a second. Well, if it took 10 seconds to get a screen full of text, you probably wouldn't think of it as very interactive. If it took a tenth of a second, the blink of an eye, you probably would have thought it was. So this was one of the fundamental limits in adoption of the internet, adoption of the web in the United States. This was the pacing item on the feed. Right, with that. So people were tortured at the last mile. So no need for your house. This is the one I hadn't expected. The web is graphical. I've been talking about text when I've been counting characters. But the web embeds pictures and things like that. And that was one of the things that distinguished the web from what came before, Gopher and things like that. So with the web, we could send you pictures. But you couldn't see pictures if you didn't have a multimedia PC. Now, you probably have never heard of a multimedia PC because all PCs do multimedia. But the year before this, 5% of the U.S. population had a PC that could display graphics. The year after this, 20% of the U.S. population had a PC that could display graphics. It was doubling every year. And this was the year it went through 10%. And so you see adoption curves that are driven by factors like this. When this number is too small, the technology doesn't impact very many people. So the adoption curve goes very flat. And then when this number hits an inflection point, it becomes large enough, the adoption rate picks up, that drives the purchase of the PCs, which further drives up the adoption rate until you saturate the market, in which case it starts to level off. And you see these S-shaped adoption curves. So the two things that were driving that adoption curve were the time to download and the graphic display capability. Now, once you had all those things in place, you could make a nice, small web. Because the thing about the web was, you didn't have to know where things were. You could just know where something was, and it would be linked to other things, and you could follow the link. So instead of you having to keep track of it, make a big list of, big hot list or something, list of favorites, you could use a small list of favorites that were things like directory pages to resources of the sort that you were interested in. Right? So you could use the web structure of the web. And gosh, you could have 10,000 websites and still use something like that. But you could not have 10 billion websites and use something like that. I mean, just exceeded the scale of what hypertext navigation, link following, was going to do for you. And so, in 1995, two things were introduced that transformed the web and created the web we know today. One was a centralized list of sites that people had decided had value. This was the business model of Yahoo, assembling such lists with the support of automation, but assessed by people. The business of a company called Lycos was to go find everything, stick it in an index that nobody had ever looked at, and if you wanted to find it, they'd look it up. Lycos is the Google of its day. Lycos actually replaced something that preceded it. And you go with Lycos had, but it indexed more of the web. Because if you didn't index it, it didn't matter how good your search algorithm was, you couldn't find it. Right? So Lycos put the predecessor out of business by indexing 10 times as much of the web. And, in an ironic twist, Lycos' successor put it out of business by indexing 10 times as much as Lycos. Lycos' successor was called Alta Vista, and Alta Vista's successor put Alta Vista out of business by indexing 10 times as much as Alta Vista, and Alta Vista's successor was called Google. Now, we'll talk about that thread, how search engines are built, next week, sometime soon. So I'll not talk too much about the technology here now, but the key is, if you can't search, it doesn't matter if it's there. And therefore, search incentivizes the production of content. Now, I'm a search guy, so this is a search-centric view of the world. Right? Search causes people to produce searchable content. You don't have search, there's strong disincentive to produce content because nobody's going to find it. Okay, so when you have all these things, you've got a web.
I just want to make sure, so like when I used Sailor in 1993 and 1994 and I didn't see any images, that just meant that my computer wasn't capable of producing those images?
Or the web pages you went to didn't have images because they were optimized for transfer over low bandwidth modems. One or the other.
One or the other, so it could have been low bandwidth modems.
What's that?
So it could have been the modem.
Yeah, there's nothing in Sailor that should have prevented you from seeing an image. Sailor was just an internet service provider.
Yeah.
Who was like his predecessor?
Called WebCrawler,
if I remember correctly.
And it too had a predecessor. And its WebCrawler's predecessor didn't have a predecessor. So a bunch of people fussing around. What the Lycos people figured out was if you wrote it to be efficient, then you could support searching at large scale at low cost. So it was a computer science triumph in Lycos to make it more efficient, which made it possible for them to, at the same cost, scale up. Once they did that, they captured the market, and once they captured the market, they could scale up further, which is exactly the trick that Alta Vista used on them, and exactly the trick that Google used on Alta Vista. Right? So people talk about all the good things in Google, and there are lots of good things that all came along together in Google. I'm not telling you this one thing did it, but there's this long tradition of if you increase the size of the index by a factor of 10, you get a competitive advantage over the previous search engine. And you incentivize further production of information. So people these days tend to think of Google as the enemy in some sense because they have a control over the indexing. So if Google will index your content, that's good, but if Google won't index your content, that's bad, and it's their choice, it's not a public choice. Google is a money-making company, not a public good. Right? So people tend to focus on the problems. But absent something like Google, it's very hard to see how something at the scale of the web today would be useful. Right? So my initial claim was Google invented the web. Well, Lycos invented the web, but that chain of reasoning. You could equally well argue that if Google didn't exist, the web would invent it. Because the web needs Google to be used. Okay, and you could make the same argument for all these other things. Once you have a web, then the web has a dynamic of its own, it creates a market, and that market then drives further innovation. Okay, and as you can probably tell, these things weren't very coordinated. You know, this is some industry trying to build a network. They weren't so concerned about what the storage industry happened to be doing at the same time. they weren't so terribly concerned, although they did realize that the motor industry had something to do with them. And those people certainly weren't thinking about subject. Right? So this is a group of people, all doing things, that came together. They made a spark that created the web. So you think of Tim Berners-Lee invented the web. Yes, Tim Berners-Lee invented the protocol at the right time. You think of the ARPANET as having been the internet. That's true. But the web is the use of the internet. So the internet is just the network. Okay. So that's really the next question. What is the web? So if I ask you to tell me which, when I was telling you, I told you these three things together are the web. The technical glue of the web is HTTP, the transfer protocol, HTML, how you extract the content, and URL, how you say where it is. But you read the O'Neill article, right? The O'Neill article talks about how big the web is. Is O'Neill talking about how much HTML there is? Is O'Neill talking about how much stuff is getting sent back and forth on HTTP? Or is O'Neill talking about how many URLs there are? URLs. So the question is, what do you think the web is? Is that the right thing to count? If I ask you how big is the web, what does that mean? Does it mean how many unique URLs are there? No. So what does it mean?
The web, we have to count in how all those URLs are linked
into
the size of it.
Okay, but the links are all links to other URLs, right? So the URL is the defining characteristic.
But the links add value to those URLs.
Yes, yes.
Just the URLs on their own are not as valuable as the other URLs are linked to.
Okay.
You have to take the links into account
to have the full web.
Right.
Okay, but you have to take the content into account too to have the full web. But if I wanted to just count something, if I just count HTML, I miss all the PDFs on the web, right? Do you think the PDF is on the web? Why? What makes you think the PDF is being on the web?
Well, not just PDFs, but all sorts of other formats.
Do you think of do you think of Microsoft Access database files as being on the web?
If they're accessible through the web, absolutely.
Really? The MDB file?
Well, yeah.
Yeah?
We upload it to the server.
Yes.
So, and then anybody can access it.
So I can transfer it over HTTP, but I can't actually view it in a web browser. I have to buy Microsoft Access and load it onto my machine.
Well, unless you somehow
embed
it.
So, when useful definition of the web is, what's my web browser able to see? The web is everything my web browser can see and nothing else.
So you could argue that if you're charged with Google downloading, you never got it from the web anyway.
Because the place that it came from wasn't on the web, because my web browser can't see that kind of thing.
Exactly.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to work. But it does. I mean, you know, you can try anything. So, I'm not asking you what the web is in an abstract sense. I'm asking you, what are we going to talk about? We talk about characterizing the web. How shall we bound this? And one way to bound it is that we're talking about characterizing the set of things your web browser can see. That's actually a little scary. Who gets to decide what your web browser can see? Don't worry, first thing about browser. Okay. And how much do they sell the browser to you for? Nothing. So, these people are defining the web. It has some commercial value for them to be able to define the web. And they're giving you the browser for free, and you're giving them the ability to define the web. They can say this is in and that's out, and you could certainly run off to some alternative browser if you see something they couldn't. Right? But if you're Adobe, and Microsoft's Internet Explorer decides not to support PDF as a native format, well, then somehow PDF's gotten written out of the web. Right? You wouldn't think a PDF is being on the web. So if we're going to take what web browsers can see as the definition of what the web is, then the people who are defining the web are the people who make the web browsers. So there are some sort of social equity issues here. Thank you. Okay. So between HTTP and HTML and URL, people often focus on URLs because URLs are the addresses web browsers use to find content. So it's most closely aligned with this question of what can the web browser see. Yeah. You learned in 8th grade or something to make static HTML pages. And only immediately before the exam did you discover that nobody really makes static HTML pages anymore. You've got to get a database and put your database up to some PHP. And if you look really hard, you can make something that looks almost as good as your original static HTML page, right? So, is that dynamically generated content on the web? Yeah, because you can put it in the web browser, right? But wait a minute. Every time I use my web browser to go there, it's different. So it's on the web, but it's sort of not there. I mean, it's a schizophrenic web page, right? Every time I look, it's changed. So how would I say what it is? Is it on the web in that sense? So people make this distinction. They have the surface web. That's the web you can see just by looking. And then they have the web that they call the deep web, which is the web you can get to by asking questions. So you've got a pull-down list, and queries to type in, and you go to the same page, google.com, but you get a different answer every time you go to the page, depending on what you type in the query box. So Google isn't a web page. It's a family of capabilities. So the deep web, you just can't think of it in the same way that you think of the surface web. The surface web's always there. You go look at it. If it's there, you put it in your index. If somebody searches for that in your index, you give them the URL. They go to it. They get what they wanted. Yeah? But with the deep web, it's generated on demand in response to a query. And so it's more complicated. Well, this would be okay if the deep web were small and the surface web were large. We would just say, oh, well, the problem is small, the thing that we can't index very well. This is the part that Google can't see. But it's not small. It's somewhere between 10 and 100 times as large as the surface web. So this is not an inconsequential difference. Now, if I go to the C-SPAN website, and I select some program that they had on a few days ago on television, they will stream to me, and I watch the streaming program, is that the web? Sure, my web browser will see it, it sort of fits our definition. But it's got this now nasty property that it's neither static nor dynamic. The dynamic stuff changed every time I looked at it. But it didn't change when I wasn't looking at it, right? I mean, it was like the refrigerator. When you close the door, the light really is off. You can't see it. But the streaming stuff, there are 2,000 radio stations in the United States alone streaming audio right now. If you're listening to it, you hear it. If you're not listening to it, it's gone. We probably can't listen to all 2,000 of them. So that's, in a sense, even more challenging than the dynamic, which is itself more challenging than that. Okay, now, if I go to a website and I ask for a web page, and it asks me for a password, and I give it the password, and it gives me the page. the page it gave me on the web. So, I'm going to browse your computer, right? So you want to browse your index, because you don't know the password. In fact, the index can't do that, because it doesn't know the password. Yes, okay? So you think it's there. So if I count the number of web pages, how would I count it if I don't have the password? So there's a distinction between public content and private content. Now, I used to work at the Office of Naval Research. And the Office of Naval Research had an internal website. They call it not an intranet, but an intranet. Thus, the internet protocols all being used internally. But it's firewalled off. You couldn't see it from the outside. It's actually tunneling into a virtual private network if you wanted to be able to navigate around on it. Or see their physical. And that gave them protection. They have grants management information on there and all sorts of things that shouldn't be out in public. Not classified things, just things that shouldn't be out in public. So it's an unclassified network. But disconnected from the internet. There were web servers in there. Some web servers have web pages. Those on the web. I can see them with my browser. Probably not, right? Because they're private. They're internal only. So, the point of all this is, if somebody tells you how big the web is, what should you ask them?
How are you?
What do you mean by the web, right? It's not a well-defined question. How many things is Google Internet? Very well-defined. Google won't tell you anything. But it's a very well-defined question. It has an answer. Right? So how big is the web? I don't know. We could be here for a long time having a debate about what should or shouldn't be thought of as on the web for some purpose. So what you always have to do is ask the question, if they tell me how big the web is, what do you think the web is? So that I can interpret your statement about how big it, you think it is on some day.
So my question is, why would you ask the question in the first place?
That
how big is the web? Does that matter?
I mean,
I'm trying to figure out why it matters for anything.
Well, let's see. I'll give you a couple of ways in which it matters. Or at least it matters to some people. There was, for a long time, a comparison running between the Library of Congress and the web. You know, which is bigger, the Library of Congress or the web? So, several years ago, it turned out that silly question because the web was so much bigger than the Library of Congress that it didn't matter how you counted it anymore. But
to why did it matter who was
there? Well, it mattered to some people, and the web is full of trash, right? So I got a lot of trash, or I got a little bit of good stuff.
Somebody's trash is somebody else's, jewel.
There we go. So in any case, people are interested in that. The other thing is this question of the public web, or the static web versus the dynamic web, the deep web. Well, if I can't talk about how big the web is, I can't talk about the fact that I get 10 to 100 times as much stuff in the deep web. Seems, I mean, if it were only a tenth the amount of stuff or a hundredth the amount of stuff, it wouldn't seem that important to me to provide people access to it. But it seems very important if it's way bigger. So there's this series of studies that was done in Berkeley, most recently in 2003. And they didn't ask how much information there is on the web. Everybody's been doing that. They asked how much information is there in the world. They said, well, okay, look. How many newspapers are there? How much stuff do newspapers publish? How often do they publish it? This many bytes for words in newspapers, right? How many academic journals are there? How many pages are there in the journal? You can see how you do that, right? And there are trade associations to keep track of all these things. You can do the math. And then you could ask the question, what source of information is generating information the most rapidly in our society? Maybe that would be the place we should pay attention to. So that's another sort of a... Do you know the answer to that, by the way?
Users. People.
Yeah. Cell phones. Remote words spoken on the cell phones. than every other source of electronically accessible information. This is a device for digital speech, right? More worse than the cell phone, than every other source of information in the world put together by a factor of 100. And only one in six people on the planet has a phone. So there's some good. So you can make comparisons like this. Whether you want to make comparisons like this or not, I don't know. But we'll see things that we'll have. How big is this? This may be useful. Okay, now here's the last one. Forget about the web for a minute. Let me just ask you about a library. Is a library defined by what you can do in it? Go to the library and check out a book, for example. You can reserve a meeting room for your classroom, or for your class, for your med school class. Or is a library defined by what you choose to do in it? Is a library a community? Is a library a set of activities? Or is a library a potential? Something that you, it gives you the ability to do things, whether you do them or not. You find both ways of thinking about libraries, right? Until tonight, how did you think of the web? Did you think of the web as a bunch of stuff you could find? Or did you think of the web as what you do on the web? Most of the information on the web is either static, dynamic, or streaming. But some of the information on the web is how you behave when you encounter that information. For example, if I have a list of every query you have ever written, I get a fair amount, don't you? And you might have some reasonable concerns about what I would do with that knowledge. First, how I would process it, but if I could process it and send it into a way, for example, to sell it to an advertiser who would market to you, you have the ability to think through whether I should be allowed to do that and what benefit you should receive in return for you allowing me to do this. Right? It's a commercial transaction. You're giving me your queries, I'm giving you some service, I now have your queries and I can use it for some commercial purpose. This is the business web search engines are in. This is how web search engines make money. They monetize the query stream. That's what web search engines have that nobody else has. With the queries, anybody can see the information on the web. But only they can see the query. So, the web is the most capable surveillance system ever created. Think about it. Think about what I can see. I can see every URL you go to, every query term you type in, how long you stay on that page, whether you later type in the same queries from someplace else. Therefore, I can figure out where you are in physical space. They're different from libraries, right? I mean, we have laws that say that you can't reveal the borrowing history of a user of a library, right? We don't have laws about revealing the web browser query logs. Yeah.
Well, you can't see what people are browsing
the library.
You only see what they
can
check
out.
So well, you could see what they are browsing
the library.
For example,
it
could be surveillance
cameras,
I guess. But.
Well, and we do keep track of usage counts on magazines. I don't know who's browsing it, but I do know it's being browsed. Because I know it's off the shelf and I use every shelf. That's why libraries will have signs that say, please don't reshelve that, so we can better use it. But in fact, we get. And faculty, we get a listing every year of the library science journals that haven't been used at all in the previous year. Along with a note that says that the library is telling them to cancel them. Right. So this is how libraries manage their collections. So there is some tracking, but it's so much better on web. Because now I can see who's doing it.
I actually heard, maybe it was going to talk about that actually one woman, like, found in her queries. Like, they actually found out her name by looking at all of her queries, it determined who the person was.
Did we talk about that in here?
That was okay.
I have her picture later on. AOL user number 441977. Well, that's the door they heard inside of it. This is the front page of the URL. If you go to this URL, which you can go ahead and just try right now, it says hanu.biz/AOL search. Okay, and then you can put in this number, 441-7749. In search user ID. There's every query this person ever asked during the hearing that was recorded, which was a couple of months long. So you have here the time, the date, and then the time. So you can see here, care packages at 9:19 in the morning, and then at 9:24 in the morning, movies for dogs. Not movies for bad dogs, movies for dogs. Okay? And then the next day, at 11:48 in the morning, Blue Book. Now, I don't know what Blue Book means to this user, but I do know that they clicked on www.kbb.com, which was in rank one in the displayed results. Kelly Blue. Ah, very good. Okay. So, and then they didn't do anything else. So I can either assume that they gave up, or they found what they were looking for. Now here, for care packages, they went to awesomecarepackages.com, which was in rank three. So now I've got a better belief that awesomecarepackages.com was for some reason attractive to them because it wasn't in the first position and they still went down the list of websites. So do you see how I can get quite a lot about you? In fact, I can tell that this person is rarely up late at night. I can also tell whether you were rarely up late at night. And not only that, I can tell which night you're up late at. So we looked at all of the emails from Enron, which were released. And we looked at what times people were sending email, and it turns out that if you're a corporate executive, you could be sending email at any time. But if you're an administrative assistant, you send email during the workday. And if you send email on the weekend, there's something going on. You got called in for it. Yeah? So I can tell what the whole organization is doing by finding a specific person send an email in an unusual pattern.
How do you find match a person with an ID?
How do you match a person with an ID? Well, here's how this one was done. Person's looking for best dog for older owner. So I'm going to guess this is not a young person. I don't know that. I'll just start to assemble some evidence here. Let's see. If we go down further, this person's asking about the Gwinnett County Yellow Pages. I'm going to guess this is an older person in Gwinnett County.
But, I mean, can someone would just put a number in the user ID randomly and try to figure out...
No, you just do this across everything. You find somebody that has a lot of them and you look at those.
Wait, how do you find somebody
without
putting in an ID?
Oh, well, here.
Random user ID.
Well, here, on search queries?
Yeah.
You're interested in people searching for what?
Oh, Doug Ord, obviously.
I'm not touching that in. Let's get something else. How about library science?
And this is only for AOL users, right? You have an AOL premium?
That's right. Now, AOL is particularly interesting in this case because normally what you have to do is when a search service writes a cookie to your computer, which you could disable, right? And then every request that comes from that cookie, we know it came from the same computer. We don't know if it came from the same person. We know it came from the same computer. But AOL, we know what screen name you were logged on. And we know every one of these came from the same screen name. And since we know people can give other screen names to their kids and the like, it's a pretty good guess that every one of these screen names is a person. Some people have multiple screen names. But a screen name is probably not being shared by many people often. So it's better than cookies. Which is what made this information so interesting. But it's so interesting, AOL wanted to find out how to build better search engines. So instead of hiring a whole lot of people, they gave away the data. So that academic researchers... No, they gave it away. They put it up on the web, downloaded here, and then they sent an email out to everybody that said it's available here. Which, of course, resulted in the New York Times downloading. And then an investigative reporter at the New York Times going through, trying to find out whether anybody could be identified. It turned out that there were several cases of Social Security numbers, which are really easily found, right? XXX-XXX-XXX, right? There were plenty of cases of credit card numbers. I mean, you know, you get something that says, please type your credit card number in here, but by mistake, you type it in over there. Did they ever type into the wrong box? Did they capture it? Permanently. And then, by AOL, post it on the web. Okay. Anyway, some people got fired.
They stopped doing it? That
why it's only they stopped doing it.
That's why it's only for
2006? The chief technology officer made a lot of requirements. The lawyers who approved it didn't. They were the ones that got the teacher's question. Anyway. So you can see here, Florida Atlantic University, Library Science, University System of Maryland, Library Science. I mean, I don't know if that's what these were, but here it is, USM Library Science, where was it? They didn't go anywhere. The FAU Library Science, they went to library.fau.edu. Probably isn't what they want.
They don't have a library science.
Yeah, I know. Library science degrees, library science schools. No, here's where they went to library science doctorate. So, let's see. I'm dying first from this person. And they clicked on Pitt, which has a library science doctorate program. Let's see who that is.
Out!
Egan. They're interested in baking soda, but are they hammer shaker? They at least know a vegan. Do they have any interest in vegans? They're working on resume writing and tofu scramble. Now that's good. Tofu scramble at 4:55 in the morning, and resume writing at 5:30 in the morning. And Vancouver at 7:35 in the morning. Anyway, you get the idea that this person, I mean, do you think you could figure out who this is? Hardcover books, Mama Dad.
Well, they're in Oklahoma City,
you
can get
them. Did you where?
They
want dry cleaning. They certainly, whatever it is they need to do, their dry cleaning in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, and there's a couple other things though.
Okay. So now we're looking for an Oklahoma City vegan.
Who has to care for aging care?
Okay.
Who likes butterflies?
And Mariah Carey and Aaliyah.
And Travis the syphilis.
You get the idea how easy it's going to be to nail down who some of these people are, and other people you're not going to get. I mean, look, to get some need, what do you have to know? College park. Information retrieval. Yeah, NASA, but there's a NASA thing nearby. Pilot. You'd be there pretty fast.
So, the web isn't the content. The web is the behavior of an interconnected set of a billion people that can be observed for the first time in human history. And this is very powerful. We can use it to build services of a kind we have never been able to build before, because we can describe content now not just by how we would index it. We can describe content by how people behave when they see it. I mean, if it markets itself virally and everybody starts looking at it quickly, we can guess that it's attractive for whatever reason, which is awfully hard to, I mean, you don't often see it in growth vocabulary tags that says, really cool, because you can measure really cool this way awfully easily. I can also measure of particular interest to visitors. Not yet. You can see how easy that would be to measure, right? I just look at what the vegans, I figure out who the vegans are by what they search for, and then we'll go with that click on. That wouldn't be hard. That'd be a very useful service. I mean, you know, you come in, you act like a vegan, and then I start finding the stuff you want to see. Isn't that good? This is from 2006. I need a picture of the atomic bomb in the mall. Realize that this is the query. And it's amazing what people type in the query box. I realize the tragic significance of the atomic bomb, having found the bomb. We've used it. We've used it against those who attacked us without warning it full hearted. That's the clear. So maybe somebody found it and said, finally the person that said this. Right? And they didn't. Well, if you were the FBI, how would you like to have a complete list of the AOL screen names of everybody who had ever asked about bombs, or attacking the president, or whatever else it is that you were charged with protecting people against? In fact, do you ever wonder why these search engines are free to use? I mean, somebody must be paying for it, right? Well, there's somebody out here collecting all this information and monetizing it somehow. Thank you for having us. Okay. Anyway, the way we got onto all that is, answer this question for me honestly. How many of you, when you came in here, thought the web was about the stuff that's on it, not about how people behave? Okay. So, I hope I've changed your mind. The web is about both the stuff that's on it and how people behave, and the stuff that's on it is sort of like the, what do you put out, cat, you have a cat to do something, right? Sort of the cat. Right? So you're able to behave in some way, and I can watch you. I can learn from it, and what I learn will have a value beyond measure. It never happens. Okay. Anyway, you spend the rest of your week thinking about whether you're happy about that. Okay, so this is from the paper that you read, what the small statement they went out and they counted websites, and they found out, now, yeah, they were not counting web pages, they counted websites, what's the website? The main page.
And then, they did count how many pages per site as well.
So what's a main page? I mean, how many main pages are there on Yahoo, for example? Does Yahoo host people's pages? Can I, like, have a page on a Yahoo server? There was some server that, I don't remember what it was now, that gave away free, oh, how about RAM?
Comcast.
Okay, fine. So Comcast. The main page is the one that says Comcast on it? I gotta count that as blunt? Doesn't make a lot of sense. Right. So I have to have some definition of a main page. You know, like, it's not linked to lots, it's linked to lots of stuff below it, but not lots of other stuff. But then I have this problem, like, what do I mean below it? I mean, there's no up and down on the web,
you're just sort of across, right?
So just this question of what a website is, I mean, we didn't know what the web was a few minutes ago, and now we're looking at websites. I don't know what a website is. Okay, anyway, whatever this is something like how many servers people want, right? Something like the number of web servers out there. A setup, not terribly bad. Anyway, there's a million, 2 million, 3 million, and it's kind of leveling off. But of course, you're measuring them in a certain way. The web's evolving in a way that makes this measurement less interesting over time. So they thought, what should we measure? Back in 1998, then they measured it consistently, and ultimately they figured out that people stopped doing more of whatever it was they were measuring. But that doesn't mean the web stopped growing. It just meant that there was a lot of stuff they weren't able to see. So indeed, what they counted was port 80 in a URL. Now this is a bit of a problem, because I've got a machine on my desk. I used to have a machine on my desk called Hawk. Wasn't a lady back then. Very warlike. Then I got a new machine, I was thinking about denominators. I called it Duck. Then Hawk stopped working. You know, we put it off in the corner, it stopped working. So we just gave Doug the initial name Hawk. So Hawk results in the same IP address as Dove results to. Well, they count it twice because they can't tell the difference. Okay, we ran into all kinds of problems. In particular, they couldn't see streaming content. Right, they were looking for HTTP servers. Okay, there are lots of studies out there you can find like this that give you some idea of that sort of thing. So, if I would actually find pages, find count pages, I have to first find the pages before I can count them, right? So the lesser included problem. So the first thing I have to do is I have to think about how do people crawl the web. So if I'm going to build a web crawler, actually I met a couple of guys at Stanford back in 1997. I went out to Digital Library Conference in Stanford. And I met a couple of guys who were very concerned. At the time, they couldn't get the web search engine companies to give them their web index. And so they couldn't do research on it. They had to actually go crawl it themselves. So they had to build their own crawler, which they hadn't really wanted to do. And so the way they did it, the way everybody builds a crawler, is they have a page, and they stuck that page on a list of pages. So they took every link on that page, they added that to the list of links to be crawled. So once they found this page, they knew these two pages existed. And then if they had this on their seed list, they could find these two pages existed. They wouldn't crawl this one twice. So now they knew about all five of these pages. And then they could, if they had another seed list, they could crawl that page. And then from the pages they knew about, they could discover these other pages. And from those pages, they could discover these more pages. And as you can see, at some point there are no more pages left to be discovered. So you get this very rapid fan out. And then once I have covered most of the web, I'm not finding very many more because it's pointing to stuff I already knew about. So I have to have some sort of checkup with, where have I seen this page before? That's called hash table, computers keep them. You can just keep the list of what you've seen before, check it if it's not on there at all. A few problems with this approach. One problem is, what order should I crawl these in? So these guys at Stanford were telling stories about how they, well, they brought attention to Stanford because they used up half of Stanford's internet bandwidth. Now this is the same Stanford that has the medical school. Presumably some of the people there were depending on the internet too. Anyway, they used up half of Stanford's internet bandwidth for this crawl. which meant that their little research project came to the attention of the company. Came to the attention of the president of Stanford. He came to the attention of the president of Stanford for another reason. Stanford started getting phone calls from people whose websites were being crawled. Now think about this. This is 1997. Is it legal for me to crawl your website? I mean, you're putting the information up for a purpose, for people to look at it, right? But I don't have a machine. It's going to come pull the information out. I'm using up your bandwidth. Not just my bandwidth, I'm using your bandwidth. In fact, they use all of your bandwidth, thus preventing anyone from seeing it. But that didn't really matter because they weren't trying to make a real web index. They were trying to just collect some data for the research. So it didn't really bother them that they had shut down your website. They didn't do it on purpose. But they simply, when they found that your website had a bunch of pages on it that were next on the list, they just got them all. And for about 20 minutes, nobody else got anything from your website because Stanford University had conducted what is now called a denial of service attack against your website, which didn't go over very well when the website was run by the U.S. government. Right? So, you guys became real famous with the powers that be at Stanford. They got to know the lawyers. They got really good at understanding social consequences of technology and the computer science things. One of them was actually a graduate of the University of Maryland. Right? His father still teaches here. And ultimately, they got this collection that the search engine companies were not willing to give them. And they wrote a crawler that behaved reasonably nicely. And they used it to develop some new algorithms, which worked very well, and founded Google. Right? And so that's pretty much. And the funny thing was, that was meeting, and one of the guys who they worked with was Tony, and he says, I never used the stuff we make, but this stuff's awfully good. I actually use it. So I went on to try this for it. It was awful. And the trick, by the way, that they came up with to make the index 10 times as large was they indexed pages before they crawled them. So before they ever seen the words on the page, they took the words on the page and put them in their index. Now, how did they do that? So what they did was when they found the link had some words that said, you know, click here for whatever. You know, click here for a picture of large fish. And they said, ooh, picture of large fish. This link. Let's stick it in the index. And if we ever go across, it's not a picture of a large fish, we'll fix our index. But in the meantime, people can search for it. Right? So they index things before they grab them. They simply have to know about it, and they have to have some of what's called anchor text. Now, why is it called anchor text?
Y'all should know this one.
The anchor
group.
What's that?
It's what you have the anchor
group. Yeah. A, href equals, right? A is short for anchor. Right? The text and the anchor. And your box. Okay. Anyway, that turned out to be sufficient, along with two other innovations, to put out of this out of business. So if you do this, what do you learn? Now, just for grins, this picture is from Altavista. So this is what Andre Berner, who was at Altavista at the time, thought the web looked like. You thought when you came in the web was content. I convinced you that the web is content and behavior. But for Andre Berner, the web is a bow tie. So, what you think of as the web is this part here, the strongly connected component. And Andre's a graph theory guy, so he thinks of graphs being nodes and links. You know, nodes you draw in circles and links you draw blocks. So you ask, how many nodes are there? Well, he's using nodes as web pages. So how many web pages are there? And he finds 56 million web pages. They're all connected to each other. Do you ever have one of those games where you're supposed to mail a letter to somebody in Cleveland? You don't know anybody in Cleveland? There's 6 degrees of separation, right? So you send a letter to somebody in Chicago. It's closer to Cleveland,
right? And you figure people in Chicago are more likely to know people in Greenville, and you happen to know somebody in Chicago. Yep. And so you play this game of trying to get the letter there in the minimum number of hops. Yep. The strongly connected component is a set of places through which you can send letters and get letters back. It says there's some number of links you could dial that would get you from any page in the strongly connected component to any other page in the strongly connected component. And from that page, there's some set of links you could follow that would get you back. Which is to say that you can get from anywhere in the strongly connected component to anywhere else in the strongly connected component by following the links. Which was, after all, what we originally thought the web was, right? That was your model of the web, right? You have a big glob of stuff, and you get between them. Yes? Okay. What Brian found was, that's less than half the web. The crawlable web. I mean, obviously the parts that can't crawl, they don't know. If the parts that could crawl. So at that time, this was like 1998, at 56 million nodes in the strongly connected component, and another 34 million web pages from which there existed a path to get to some node in the strongly connected component, after which you can get to any other node that goes in the next component. So you could get from this in part, in here, but you couldn't get from here back to there. So these are inlinks into the strongly connected code. This is sort of what you thought the web was. And what it says is, there's a bunch of stuff out there nobody's linking to, but it's linking out. Think about it. You shouldn't be surprised by this. Your 690 web pages, when you built them, nobody had linked to them yet. But you were linking to other people. You were sitting here in the in part, which is to say, you could get from your page to something in here. Then you can play around here. Another 44 million nodes that are linked to by some page in the strongly connected component. But once you get there, there's no going back. You can't get back into the strongly connected component. There's an event horizon that blocks you. You can get out of the strongly connected component, but once you're gone, there's no link back in. Oh, playing a streaming video would have this characteristic, right? Go play a streaming video, fine. Streaming video played. Where do I go from there? I don't know. I can't click on anything in my streaming video. Right? So, it's not too surprising that the web is a bow tie. You don't need to have a bow tie. You just need to have a banner to draw it for you. Yes? But you already have in your mind the kinds of things that design a bow tie. They must exist in some numbers. Here's what Andre found that can surprise you. These two together are better than the strongly connected web. What you thought was the web isn't. The web is mostly the stuff out here, not the stuff in there. So, feeling that comes to you. If your blog might be here, it's just your blog. Okay? So, most of the information on the web isn't in this place where you can get anywhere. Now, not only can you get out of this part and into the strongly connected component, you get out of this part and into nowhere. I mean, think about it. You have a page that links to another page you built. And the other page you built goes nowhere. Doesn't link to anything. So there are these outbound tentacles. Well, these things link about themselves, but they don't link any of these. So the web is not really a bow tie.
Really
the web is a bow tie, sort of married to an octopus. Okay, anyway, something happens on the outside. Then there are all these disconnected components. And you can actually even get from here to there. So now you know what the web is, right? Okay. So let's come back in 10 minutes and we'll talk about what to do with it. Thank you.
You don't have to. Perfectly qualified to develop.
And so one of the problems with wet crawls is it's really easy to crawl the strongly connected component, but it's much harder to crawl the peninsulas, and it's very hard to crawl the islands because you have to find feed in the islands. And so one time I put a page up and I relied on obscurity to prevent people from being able to find a page. So it's a non-password protected page, so I didn't bother with that. I just put up a bunch of stuff that I didn't think a lot of people would see, but I didn't give anybody the URL, and I didn't link to it myself. Now, such a page can never be crawled. How would they find it? Yeah. Turns out my web server has a very helpful list of newly added pages that it publishes at some URL. So Yahoo found it and crawled it. Yeah. Okay. And even if that hadn't happened, somebody that I sent a note to might have put it in their hot list, in their favorite list, and then they might have shared the favorite list with one of these services that ultimately tells the shared favorite list to Yahoo. So, okay, so I mean, web search engines have to be very clever to be able to index these islands as densities, and they work very hard on that, because it's a very differentiated one web search engine from another. An enormous problem for the web search engines is that about, a third of the content on the web exists in more than one place. So I crawl it, go to all the trouble to download it, and then later in that crawl, from a different URL, I get the same information. Because people mirror information on different sites so that I can serve it more quickly to people in Europe or in the US or whatever. So there are lots of mirroring sites. And that wouldn't be a problem if this was very little of the information, but if it's a third of the information, lots of the work I do is being wasted because I'm downloading the same information over, indexing the same information over. But it's worse than that. Because if I put this in position one in the search results for you, what am I going to put in position two? Something equally good. In fact, really equally good, the same thing, which is probably not too helpful to you. Right? So you'd probably like me to remove the duplicates from my index. Or a few other things you'd like me to remove from my index. On web pages that aren't there anymore. So how long does it take to crawl the web? Here are your possible answers. A second, an hour, a week, a year. What do you think? So, web search engines have to terminate at some point their crawl and start over. It's very, very difficult for them to keep track of what's changing. So what they do is they crawl and throw away the crawl. Crawl, throw away the crawl. Crawl, throw away the crawl. That's how they know what's changing. Crawls are units. And they take weeks to do. Now how can I build a web page that has current content? Content that was just added yesterday. It's a crawl takes me weeks. So I could set up a crawl. And let's say it takes me 3 weeks, I can set up another crawl a week later. But still, that means I'd have like a month away from the time the web page goes up until the time it shows up in some crawl. Because it takes me 3 weeks to do the crawl. So I can interleave them, that's good. But still, I can't find it the same day as another. But my search engine company wants to put your search engine company out of business by indexing things sooner. Like news, for example. 3 weeks old news, really not going to be a large market. Yeah. But 15-second old news, that's pretty good. 15-second old financial news, that's really good. What's that?
You just crawl from
here to
them, or starting a new crawl, or
do
you like...
But still it takes 3 weeks to do a crawl.
Can you prioritize when you crawl?
Yeah, just every 5 minutes, just crawl a bunch of new stuff. You can crawl everything just because you started your crawl. You can focus your crawling on certain things. So this is what search engines have to do. They interleave the general crawls, and then they use targeted crawls. And when you do a search, they search both the most recent targeted crawl, and if they don't find it there, they go back to the general crawl. So that's kind of some way of putting these together. Okay, so the general clause allow me to remove lists that don't exist. But I do have a problem. Let's say that I have a web page that's served by my server. Actually, I had this happen to me when I was doing my dissertation. And the server is in Athens. And at night when they turn off the light, the server goes off. And I'm in Athens. Which meant, since computer scientists only work at night, it was actually never available. It existed most of the day, because I was the one I was sleeping. So for me, it was as if this thing didn't exist. It took me like a month to figure out that, you know, it was just being turned off. That's because people left the office. Now, if I'm running a web crawler, and the entire network in Uzbekistan got cut by somebody, you know, grabbing a hose through a field. My next web crawl will have nothing from Uzbekistan. It's like all of a sudden Uzbekistan has been deleted from the planet. Now you might think, okay, fine, so we lost all of the high quality English content from Uzbekistan. Yeah? Try it from California. I can't afford not to index California. Right? So if it turns out I got a little 2-hour Netflix that keeps me from getting stuff from California, I want to go back and check again. So I have to be able to tell the difference between a page that's not there right now and a page that will never be there again. And there's no really firm boundary between the two, except don't check the same time of day. Okay. So link browser is a problem. Dynamic content generation is a problem, and it's two kinds of problems. One is I ask for something on pull-down forums, I get it. I ask for something different, I get it. What am I putting in this? The most recent thing I saw from the site. So already it's hard to index dynamically generated content. But the spammers figured this out. And so what they do is they say, ah, I want to serve this web page to everybody who's looking for Caribbean cruises. It's a web page about, I don't know, Viagra. Okay, so what do? I make a web page that says Caribbean cruises, cheap Caribbean cruises, nice Caribbean cruises, everything about Caribbean cruises, lots of information about Caribbean cruises. And if you come to my website, of course, you send them the HTTP GET request, you identify yourself as a web crawler to be polite, I will serve you that page. But if you come from Internet Explorer, I'll serve you the Viagra ad. So now you force the web search engine company to pretend to be Internet Explorer. So that they don't get spooked. So this is dynamically generating content on purpose. Right? This is called cloaking.
After the robot.
Okay, so crawling isn't nearly as easy as it was. So I told you that 30 to 40% of the web is duplicates, and you're sitting there going, okay, yeah, 30 to 40% of the web is duplicates, okay. More than I would have thought, but I understand what you said. But just like everything else tonight, what's a duplicate? So let's say that I have two pages, two web pages. They come from mirrors of the same site. The site is like, you know, Linux C compilers, binaries. You know, and then here's a bunch of binary files. All in the same, right? Index structure is the same. And you look at that and you say, looks like it's probably got the same stuff, but I'm not going to bother looking any further. I've already seen something like that. Okay. That's a duplicated directory structure. Might not be duplicated content. Might be more up to date or something like that. But that's one way. I can think of it structurally. So mirrors work this way, or I told you about aliasing. Dove and Hawk were also aliased to Cliss, www.cliss.umd.edu, or something else, www.drg.umd.edu. Somebody's registered some other thing. And I kept getting a phone call saying, can you please take down this web page? I'm like, well, I don't really have the web page up. But it turned out that the machine was known by some third name I never heard of. Okay. Now, when I said duplicates, you probably were thinking, duplicates? I mean, I got these bytes in this file, I got the same bytes in another file. It's the same, right? That's what you thought duplicates was. So, what if I give you the same content, the exact same content, but I take the time on the bottom of the page. Is it a duplicate?
Depends on what kind of web page you're
doing. Good. It depends on your purpose.
So if I go to the search engine, and I've got two pages that are identical except for the time at the bottom, probably I want to show the user both. But for some things I'm going to do, I would want to show the user both. What if it's exactly the same page except one of them has a different banner at the top? Now, from the perspective of the searcher, it's the same page, right? It's not the same site, but it's the same page. What if one of the pages is in English, and the other page is the same page in Spanish? You know, there's some, you know, click here for English, click here for Spanish, right? Is that a duplicate? No. I finally exceeded your duplicate threshold?
Yeah, because, I mean, it's the same... I don't speak Spanish, so the Spanish page is useless to me, whereas the English one would give me information.
So those are different.
Yeah.
If you spoke Spanish, would they be different?
To me, maybe not, but to the general public, yes.
Okay. So there are all these questions that come up with duplicate detection on the web. And if I just count the bytes, it's not going to work. I have to think about what the purpose is and figure out where to run. They broke out the folks at Stanford in trouble. They closed everything, including stuff people didn't want to crawl. Now, do you have a right not to have your stuff crawl? Aren't they wrong to constitute what?
I mean, I think that I can put it up. Are these people that don't want their stuff to crawl, putting it up on the web?
Yeah.
Okay, well then...
They're kind of not thinking straight if they don't want to crawl and they put it on the web, right? So let's say you take that position. And I take you to court. And I say, look, I own this information. This is copyrighted information. And I hold the copyright. And I am willing to allow you to use it for the following purposes, which I will put in writing at the top of the page. And indexing it is not one of them. You ever see that instruction at the beginning of a book that tells you the long list of things that you can't do, which essentially is everything that Google Books is doing?
Yeah.
And indexing is one of the things forbidden by the usual text at the front of the book. Automatic indexing, content-based indexing. So, if I can do this in the book world, why can't I do it in the web world? And the answer is, well, writing on the page, please don't crawl me, is not going to help. See, Mr. Crawler, don't crawl me. Well, help the crawler going to know. All right, it can't read. So what you do is you give it metadata that says, don't crawl me. Like that flag. Like, don't tread on me. It's a don't crawl me flag. And there are two places you can put the flag. You can put the flag in a file at the top level. So the first thing a crawler has to do when it goes through this site is go to /robots.txt and see if there's a list in there of directories that should not be crawled. And if it doesn't follow that rule, nothing will happen. And there are no police who will then all of a sudden materialize and shut down the crawler. On the other hand, the people who build servers, if crawlers didn't follow the rule, would start to put in ways of blocking servers by IP. You'd get a little war going. So just to keep that war from happening, the crawlers respect the robots.txt file. This is called the robots exclusion protocol. Right? Because the crawler is a robot. Now, you can't do this. RAM, because this is at the top level of RAM. So, what you have to do is you have to put metadata inside your file. So then don't call me. So then, the search engine goes out, crawls it, gets it, looks at it, and says, oops, and throws it away. Which is less efficient. So there's a disincentive to doing that, some search engines just ignore it. So that you'll use the robots.txt, which is more efficient for them. They just look at it once for every purpose. Okay. So if you have stuff you don't want to build,
and you put it out there, and you don't link to it, counting on nobody to index it, you'd do better if you put up robust exclusions in the file. Okay, so you can actually see some of these dead calls. Let's see. So you can go into the web browser to archive.org. Normal spelling. And there was a guy who graduated from MIT some years back who started the competitor to the web search engines called the Wide Area Information Service. And what he did was he made a local search engine that would index your site, your site, your site. And then all these search engines would communicate with each other. Sort of like V3950, if you know about V3950. Except it predated that. And it's called Wide Area Information Service, or WAIS. And actually, web browsers will, at least would for a while, follow the WAIS protocol. It never took off, but he started another company called Alexa, which would let you see what other people were doing on the web at the same time with the same content you were looking at. It would introduce you to other people who were looking at the same pages. And incidental to that, he made a set of crawls, and then he donated the crawls to himself, thus getting a tax write-off. Remember this, April 15th is tomorrow. So he created a private foundation, charitable foundation, and he took the web crawls from his company and he donated them to his charitable foundation, which would preserve the crawls in perpetuity, directly on top of the San Andreas Fault. So this is in the Presidio of San Francisco, a closed military base, but it's directly on top of the San Andreas Fault. Now, he then wanted to actually preserve these, surveyed how information had moved through history, and learned, as you probably already know, that people go crazy every once in a while. And they do this in every kind of social grouping that's ever been tried. But rarely do all the people on the planet go crazy at the same time. So if you can just give this stuff to people who don't like each other, then maybe one of them will survive. So this is, I mean, you know, this is the Arabic bringing the books from the classics of Greek literature into the present, right? So the next place he put it, he replicated the entire Internet Archive, and he put it in Alexandria, Egypt, in the rebuilt Bibliothèque Alexandria. And when he gets done, it's like, so where would you put the first one if you were thinking straight? Not directly on top of the San Andreas Fault. Where would you put the second one? Probably not in the hardest place on the planet to get all the technology delivered to and working. Right? Okay, so there's two copies of this now, and he wants to put the third one in China. Anyway, so here it is. And then he built a little search engine for it. The search engine's got a cute thing. So let's look at the URL. You know the, we don't have a CLIS webpage anymore, it's an iSchool webpage. Okay, so we can actually go see the CLIS webpage. It's still there. Okay, so here's the CLIS webpage. And these are the dates of the crawl. So there was a crawl that on this date ran across the CLIS webpage. The crawl got updated. So you can see what did the CLIS webpage look like on November 11, 1998. The new photo gallery. Eric Clearinghouse in Assessment and Evaluation. Alumni Day 1998, How to Succeed by Really Trying. And the Fall 1998 Continuing Education Program. So we can look at that. And you can see up here, there's the URL, www.clis.umj.edu. Here's this earlier URL, www.archive.org/web/, and then there's the date, and then the URL. So you can take any URL, put a date in front of it, and put www.archive.org, issue it to a web browser, and you too can get this error message. But the problem is, all these pages weren't crawled on the same date. So they're linking from a page on that was crawled on one date to a copy of another page that was crawled on a different date. So the page may not even be there yet, right? On this earlier date.
Fortnite have already rotted away on some later date, or they might not have paid full price for their servers on top of the San Andreas Fault, and if you try it again, you might get this. So we'll try again. And it failed again. Now, that's because I picked the November 11th one. If I picked the December 12th one, you'll see, we had a lot more on the website by then. Right? And since that's all IZ90A continuing education program, one of the things there, you can click on it, and you get it. And so what was happening was the very earliest one was trying to go to an appropriately early copy of the other thing, which hadn't been called. Right. But if I just go to a slightly later one, and go to a nearby version of that, we're fine. See how that works? Yes? Okay, so you can have all kinds of fun with this. For example, you go to Photo Gallery, which unfortunately they did not crawl photographs in Alexa's business, and so they're not there. But a few years later, the photographs started to appear. And so if you want to see a few years later, you can go to 2003. So you can do a sort of retrospective of, you know, cliff through the ages. I don't know what you're trying to do. Most stars mean that they detected a difference with duplicate detection. So here, we finally figured out that, you know, red should be one of our colors. We got a picture of some books. I mean, this is getting a whole lot better here. Right? We've got a little bit of a hierarchical organization with actually books like at my Bill Albers School. Anyway, and you can see the URL or the email address for the webmaster and all that stuff. And just for fun, you can see which faculty were here. Anyway, you get the idea. Is that kosher? Can I crawl your web page and then serve it back forever? I mean, if you put up there, you know, I am a rabid Republican. I believe in, I don't know what a rabid Republican believes. Low taxes. If later you want to go work for a Democratic congressman, maybe you'd like that part of the web to be gone. So there's been quite a lot of discussion about how Gen Y, the people who come after Gen X, right, the younger people grew up with all this technology, they're like, they live in a voyeuristic society where they allow people to see things about their life that frankly would make my generation a little old. Well, they might make their generation feel that way too by the time they're my age, or it might not. We don't know. Right? I mean, things change. One of the things that changes is the people doing this stuff. And so, does Mr. Kale have the right to keep your past? Indeed, did Cliff have a copyright on that page? Isn't Brewster Kahle serving copyrighted content? I mean, not the awful lot of stuff that he's serving, but copyrighted. Is this, like, okay? I mean, it's there, right? So, it must be okay.
Is there anything like the robot little tag
you
can throw, like, in that archive?
Well, you could certainly put in do not crawl, and it does not crawl, and the archive just as it crawls. Or you could dynamically serve it. I mean, you could make your web, make your class project a PhD project, and then they couldn't crawl it, because it'd be dynamically generated. Or you could go ask him to take it off, except that he'd be answering the phone direct the time, right? Mm-hmm. People put stuff on the left. But that's what they do. And that's patterned after copyright law. There is an affirmative defense to a claim that you have violated copyright to remove the material from accessibility while the claim is resolved. As long as you're behaving in good faith. You put it up in good faith, and you take it down when somebody asks you to. So yes, you can ask that things not be archived, and you can ask that things that are archived be removed. We can go ask that all that good stuff be taken off. Okay. Now, we're using this word archive awfully loosely. How many archivists in the group? So, like, is this an archive? It's everything. So we don't know where it came from. We know the URL.
Well, yeah, but
yeah.
Not necessarily everything else.
It's not described.
Yeah.
It's not arranged. Almost nothing you would associate with archive is present here in the internet archive. Right? So if you ask any random group of 10th graders whether this is an archive, what would they say?
Mm-hmm.
How about any random group of students on this campus?
Mm-hmm.
How about any random group of people? No? So there's something interesting going on here. I mean, it is an archive, because people think it is. That's what they call it. But it's not an archive in the sense that we think about archives. So is it challenging our view of what an archive is? I mean, after all, this stuff's not arranged, because it's self-arranging. It's not described, but it's self-describing. It's not selected, but it's self-selected.
And it also
has a reason
why archives have to be selected,
if
it's
in a
state.
Right, and well, it does in some sense. I mean, somebody's paying to store this stuff. Mr. Kale's foundation, you know, it's got a tax deduction for donating stuff to itself, but it's paying for those discs. Right? So it is quite, I mean, if they archived from the word, if they kept 10 times as much stuff, it would cost them 10 times as much. So how much they're paying to keep this stuff thin, they're paying 10 times as much to do 10 times as much. And if you look at what happened, back in the early days, they didn't have very much CLIPS. You know, it's not because there wasn't a lot of CLIPS there. It was there every day you wanted to look at it. But they didn't call it very much because the discs were expensive. And you could actually see the discs get cheaper. Right? That's Moore's Law. Why are the discs cheaper? To the point where, you know, this goes down quite a long way. You know, here's a call on April 26th, another call on May 2nd. But, you know, here's one December 5th, and then there's the December 6th call. Here's the second call on December 6th. So if other people figure out that they're just like Lister, you could donate your call and save money. So everybody started donating their call, even if they didn't need it. Right? So interesting sort of social issues about how you should develop a practice around this, because there's no legislation around this. So society is developing a way of sort of taking the pattern from copyright and applying it here, because it needs to work over there. Right? And at right about the same time, it's kind of breaking over there, we're getting DMCA and all that stuff. Right?
I just have a question.
Yeah.
Do they have to fight over any copyright to the way
You mean trademark issues?
Yeah, trademark issues.
I don't know. Well, it's the Internet Archive Wayback Machine.
Okay.
So maybe Wayback Machine was already trademarked or something.
Okay. Well, isn't it?
Is it? Before these
months? Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, maybe that's where they got the idea. Okay, anyway, the Internet Archive is very nice for helping you to think through. Can we save everything? Should we save everything? What can we do with everything that we save? For example, the ability to make things like the Internet Archive means that Hollywood doesn't deposit their content in archives. incumbents. But if we could guarantee them there wouldn't be something like the Wayback Machine, they might be more willing to come in and do a drug car. There are consequences to making things accessible. Okay. So this is a good one. There's not 10 to 11 times larger, there's 10 to 5 times larger. And we're running faster. These guys are old. Here's the picture. This is all material that has ever been printed. When you read this, this is in terabytes. So I'll fight as a character, and megabytes a million characters, a gigabyte a billion characters, and a terabyte a trillion characters. And this is less than 1,000 trillion characters. So, less than a quadrillion characters. And everything. So all the different characters. Yeah, it's different here, and a lot of copies. Now, if you go from 1994 to 1997, there's a lot more stuff published. I mean, this doesn't look like much, but look, you go from here to here, it's 10 times as much. You go from here to there, it's 10 times more. It's 100 times more than that. That's 1,000 times more than this. See the scale? It's one of these compressed scales, long scale. See how that works? Okay, so there's a lot more stuff published in 97. Way more stuff published by 2000. By 2003 doesn't look very big, but if you plotted this on ordinary scales, a lot of stuff didn't publish. So here's the surface web. In 1994, there is no surface web. In 1997, the surface web compared to all stuff that's been published, pretty good. 2003, still not as much in the surface web as everything that's ever been published. But between 1997 and 2000, the deep web exceeds in terabytes everything that has ever been committed to paper, to publish. But it doesn't exceed it by a little bit. So this number there is 100 times as big as this number here. And almost 10,000 times. So the deep web is the web. The surface web is just the part that can be crawled. But the deep web is the information content. Anybody want to guess what's on this deep web? Photographs. Photographs of the Earth. So there are satellites flying around the Earth, and they take photographs. And where do the photographs go? To a data center, right? And how many terabytes do they have in them? Well, I don't know, some fraction of a terabyte in every photograph. And how many photographs do they take? I don't know, one every couple of minutes, right? In every satellite, all the weather satellites, all the Earth resources satellites. Or laser measurements, or all the, everything, that every telescope looking at the sky. Right, every single thing, every image. And these ones are almost entirely images. Because picture is not worth 1,000 words, it's like something worth 1,000,000 words in terms of scope. All those pictures are Mars. Then we figured out how to compress where that went. Or Jupiter or whatever it was. Okay. Anyway, that's what all this stuff is. Stuff facts, not books. Now, that's this part of deep web. Publications only account for 11%. Whatever time this was snapshot, it's probably around 2003. Only 11% of the deep web is publications. Now look at this. There's the deep web. 10% of that is not here. Right. 11% of the publications is something like here. So, most of the information on the deep web is photographs. But there's still more
text content, published content on the deep web than there is in hard copy. All those journal guns that people have are in the deep web, every one of the journal websites. Every newspaper is there. Anything anybody has put up as searchable text is in the deep web. So, in particular, the search engines themselves are in the deep web. And therefore, the shallow web is in the deep web. Because it can be found through the search engines. Which is everything that we'll talk about next week about how to index the subject is false when it's academically false. So, at the time this was done, the largest deep web site was the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which had only 356 girls. Ran 66 terabytes right last year. Somewhere between 100 terabytes and 1,000 terabytes last year. Pretty close to everything that's ever been published. You're sitting in one website, in one government agency. Which makes the information management of that content a fairly important problem.
Rethink doing the PHP.
Alright. One of the really nice things about the World Wide Web in its early days was that it wasn't worldwide. It really was the English Wide Web, or even particularly the American Wide Web. That's where most of the content was. And so it was very easy because I would just type into my search engine what I wanted to find, and I found it because the words would match. And I could read it because I typed in words in that language and I got it back. Now, if you think like an American, then the first question you would ask is, well, doesn't everybody speak English? And the answer is, not if you live in Queens, New York, which is the most linguistically diverse library system in the United States. It's something like 32 different languages of content in their collection because they have people who read those languages. So you think about that and you're like, well, how many people like that are there? So this is a survey done some time back, 90 data, and then they ask how many people are at least 5 years old so they might be able to speak some language, and then how many of them speak English not well, not at all, or with some difficulty, and that turns out to be a growing fraction of the population. That's in 1990 up to about 8%. And you look at this and you're like, it's not just an English-wide web, it's a worldwide web. So now the question is, what fraction of the people searching are searching in, let's say, English, and what fraction of the information is in English? What fraction of people searching are searching in Chinese? And what fraction of information is in Chinese? Want to make a bet which group is linguistically advantaged? Well, anybody want to try a language? English, wrong. Well, actually, we're going to do the special one.
Well, they speak English.
Yes, yeah. But it's not one of their official languages. French, German, and Italian. So let me see if I understand you right. We have the money, therefore we're going to do it in English, and if you don't like it, that's too bad.
Yeah. Hooray!
Yeah.
That sounds very American.
So, if you looked at where money is, you would come up with something that vaguely resembles this list. I mean, in 2008, China would be quite hard. But it's the United States, Germany, Japan, United Kingdom, France, China, Italy, Canada, Netherlands, Hong Kong, which was not in 2001, accounted for by the World Trade Organization as part of China.
You just take all of those, and that would be like all the money in the world was in the hands of the people who spoke those languages. Might as well be better. Right? And then you ask the question, what's the language distribution of the internet? So how do I do this? I build a search engine that does it. Random sample from a crawl. Right? So I just take the Zoom key list. Very similar to what the folks at OCLC did. And I guess what language I get for every piece of content I get back. So how do I guess what language I get? Well, let's say the most common word is the. What do you have that in English? What is the most common word is el? E-L. Well, I guess Spanish? You know, I could just take a list of the most common words in the most common languages, and I can just see which list matched better. That would be right almost all the time. Language identification is an extremely simple problem. So, even if I make a mistake, it will come out in the statistics. So it's easy to count web pages. So here's the count of web pages. At the time that this was done, so this is September 2003 data projecting forward to 2004.
The last time I figured out how to get
PowerPoint
walking.
Two-thirds of the web pages on the web were in English. One-third of the people on the web spoke English as their first language. So this is done by, you know, where's the IP address and what do they speak there? You know, this is an estimate. So, what do you think is happening to this percentage of people who speak English as their first language? What's that? No. But what do you think is happening to their numbers? This is 2003, right? 2004. What do you think it looks like in 2008? How could it be going down? There are not fewer people using the internet who speak English, are there? They're wanting to speak other things, right? Which other things? How about, let's see, this is English, and then Chinese, and then Japanese. You think Japanese is going up or down? Up, because there are so many people in Japan that didn't have internet by 2004. Oh, no, okay, down. Same reason as English, right? Okay, how about Spanish? Up, penetration in South America wasn't very good in 2004. It's getting better. How about German?
Same
or down, right? See how this works? Two factors. How big is the population? What fraction of its country? Okay, now, which of these languages do you think it is undergoing the most rapid growth? Chinese. Yes? So, if you look at it now, Chinese is going up, English is going down. Great. You can look at pictures at one time, and you can sort of move them forward, figure out, okay, this is how people do it, like photo futures and stuff like that, right? It's not commodities, not just chip prices, yes, but the demographics are. Okay. What about the content? I got 68% of the stuff in English, and there's really no justification for that, except that 58% of the money in the world is in English. What's happening with that? Evaluation right now, but in the longer term trend, what's so special about Latin?
The root for several languages.
Yes, and it's the root for several languages because?
Because they conquered.
People who spoke it took over the world, right? Okay. What's so special about German?
Well,
no, they didn't actually succeed in taking over.
They took over another part of the world?
Took over the academy. Mm-hmm. German was the language of the academy, yes? Mm-hmm. There is, at every time in human history, some language that had a capture effect on the content. And that capture effect is self-perpetuating because people get trained to speak that language. For whatever purpose that language is being used, either a language of commerce or a language of science
which, by the way, happened to be the same language today.
Right.
So there's a very, very strong texture effect on image. So what do you bet is happening to this 58%? Decreasing slope. These are underserved languages, so there is a pressure driving them up. But they're going to hold for a very long time, likely be this asymmetry. Most of the people in the world do not speak English as their first language, and most of the information in the world is in English. Which makes this World Wide Web thing all of a sudden seem like a big deal, because I can't just search for your credit returns in the documents, give them back to you, and have you be happy. That would work very well if you speak English, which will disadvantage you if you're in this shrinking region here, so it will advantage you there. But it won't work very well for you if you happen to speak Russian. So I gave this talk in Russia to Yandex, one of the Russian search engines, and I said, please, 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 you know how to solve this problem, I'll tell you next week. Please build it. Somebody ought to build one of these things. So we can cross this barrier using translation. Except the translation is really awful. The search is really awful. So they go well enough. Okay. Here's some data. It's quite older than that. This is like 1997 data. This is very late. And look what's happening here. These are people building web pages in Europe. We've been asked the question, in what language do they know their websites? They either build it in the native language, or English, a lot of them do. Or they build it in English only. So 42% of them build it in the native language only, 11% build it in English only, just to keep the numbers from getting munched. The UK and Ireland were just held out. Right? So you can look at this and say, okay, well, this number is 4 times that number. There's 4 times as much stuff that's not in English as in English. But look at this, there's twice as much stuff that's in both English and the native language of the area. Some language of the English. So you look at this and you say, okay, this is how people behave when we just sort of say, look, we have no special technology to take care of this. Do whatever makes sense. Right? And sort of a snapshot of what happens. Some people do it only in English, some people do it only in another language, and some people do it in both. What do you guess has happened to this one? In Europe. That's what you would guess.
Native, but not necessarily English bilingual. It might be like French and German bilingual.
That you'd also guess that. Somebody guessed native? Or what's happened is, in language, because this is a time in Europe in 1997, when there was a strong cultural imperative to maintain a national identity. So you meet older Europeans during this time who say, oh no, I am a European. As if that was something different than the way they've been thinking before. You know, of course, I am a European. They don't say that anymore. But the interesting thing was, every time anybody ever says to me, I am a European, do you know what language they said again? Because it's the only language everyone in Europe speaks. It's everyone's second language. So English has actually grown in the wealthiest multilingual society on the planet as a fraction of the market all the time. And I ask people about this, I say, what happened? And they said, we stopped worrying about all that. And we're just trying to make money. And if you were trying to make money, you would use the language of commerce. And the language of commerce, back to the beginning, is English. All right. Anyway, so these surveys, just how much of this is there? Why should I care? I don't know. It's interesting insights in how much there is of these relative. This is a problem. That's what we'll think about. What is wrong? You know, it's easy, right? It's just a mod, but what is wrong?
A web mod.
It's a
The world is circular. What's a web blog?
Online journal.
It's an online journal. What's an online journal? This still seems circular. How do I know when I see it? What does it look like? What does it have? What can I do with it? Okay. That's it. Anything that had media linking and tag clouds and text were there. It's a lot. I'm just kind of like a news. So far, all your projects were blogs by your previous definition. But they're not, because you're just web pages, your projects. Nobody's doing a blog, right?
Discrete blocks of text with comments?
Ah! Discrete blocks of text with comments in a time order. Yes? Yes, maybe a blog or something like that. Or something. Okay, so you could start to. It's actually a problem when you go to crawl blogs, you're like, what's a blog? Well, if it's something with a URL, we're back to, it's a web page, right? So figuring out what it is you're talking about, like, I had to answer the question, what's Chinese, before I could count it. So you have to answer the question every single time, what is a blog? And then once I do that, I can ask the question, how many blogs are there? And so here's what these people are called. This is a search engine company that evolved to look at blogs. And so between August of 2003 and February 2004, the number of blogs doubled from not very many to not very many. And then they doubled again 5 months later, and 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 then they ran out of room on the graph. So what do you bet? Is that going to double again forever? How many people are there on the planet? How many people are there that are connected to the internet? Okay, how many people on the planet? Let's start there.
6 billion.
6 billion? How many of them connect to the internet? Within a factor of 10, maybe? A billion. Yeah, okay. About a billion people. About a billion of those cell phones, or about a billion people connect to the internet. Cell phones connect to the internet is sort of a stuff that goes on. So, we're 20 billion, right? How many times do I have to double to get from 20 million to a billion? I mean, everybody's going to have a blog already. But that didn't happen. Right? Does your mother have a blog? So, what's that?
Some people don't want
blogs. So, there's some limit to this growth, right? So you see this all the time. You see this adoption curve. It gets a sharp inflection, and at the time it gets a sharp inflection, what does everybody do? They go, oh my God, it's doubling every 5 months, and then what do we start acting like? It's going to double every 5 months forever. Pretty soon, every atom in the world is going to be serving blogs, right? It must stop doing that sooner or later. Okay, so what can you see with blogs? Take a break, come back, and we'll talk about that.
I thought you were going to do our
That's right, you know how, I don't even, you know what, I never, I can't remember.
They're in your email, but what are your emails?
Unwell, right.
I'm putting one in the back burner. I'm putting that in the back burner.
Oh, yeah. Hey, it's her credit, not ours, so, yeah. So,
digitizing all these books. I mean, how could Google possibly make money by digitizing books?
Okay.
Come to their site, right? Okay. They can sell ads to people who come to the site. Are you good at this? Why else? What else? So think like Google now. What do I have? I don't really have control over it. I got all these copyright patterns I got to fight, which aren't really thought out, right?
They have a brand. And if people know that they can, if people want to search for books anyway, regardless.
So you can find everything at Google. Then no matter what you want, you're likely to go to Google. So they're trying to establish a brand. Okay, so that's the second one. You've got to think like Google. You're not thinking like Google yet.
Billion.
Okay.
Another
way to find
people.
Okay, but they sound like they're in the same. Okay. So, remember I told you the web isn't what's there. It's how people behave and what they're behaving with respect to. So Google makes its business by giving you good answers to your questions, helping you to find good answers to your questions, right? Now, answering your question is fairly easy. You just find some things that have the words in it that are in your question. We'll give them to you if you decide if you're happy. But Google doesn't like write books. They just find stuff to give it to you. Right? They don't write web pages. They just find what's there and hand it to you. The hard part for Google is to recognize what's good. Recognizing what's on topic is the easy part for Google. They're not perfect at it, but it's the relatively easy part. Recognizing what's good is one of the three things that made Google famous.
we'll talk about next week. What they figured out was people that a lot of people went to have good information.
Really didn't need a PhD in computer science to figure that one out.
And indeed, neither of the guys who founded Google have a PhD in computer science because they quit to go start the company. All right? Okay. So, finding high quality information is the second thing Google did, in addition to indexing more information, that made their system better. By the way, just fun. The third thing they did was that before Google, every search engine company had 420 pages on the front page, and you had to figure out where to type the query. And Google was founded by someone who was advised by one of the best people in the country on human-computer interaction. And actually, met him one day. We made a very complex search system. And he said to me, sorry, whatever his name, he said to me, Doug, what are you trying to make? A violin or a kazoo? And I'm like, either one. Let me try to explain it again. And he was like, no. He said, look, here's the thing. I can make beautiful music with a violin, but it takes me a long time to learn to play it. He says, I can make music right away with a kazoo, but if I work on it for very long, it doesn't get any better. You try to make a violin or a kazoo. Google is a kazoo. I mean, you put somebody in front of Google and say, do something. What am I going to do? There's a box on the screen. There's something else they can do. It's the ones in the box on the screen. Right? So it was very carefully thought through, the human computer interaction stuff. Okay. But I'm still going to ask the question, why do they want to digitize all these books? So what's Google doing? They find words in your queries that are in the documents. They give more weight to the words that indicate topicality, like wrong words, than the words that are present in every document, like sure words. Right? They got some secret sauce for doing that. Putting together all these sources of evidence. And what they want to find you is on-topic documents that are high quality. Now, what if I gave you a bunch of words that were selected by people who studied quality? And these are the words that are associated with high-quality information. Google would pay for that, right? Because these words would be better words than other words. Right? So, for example, I would not have triple X, right? XXX, that probably wouldn't be in my list of really good words. And things like librarian, they'd be in my list of good words. Right? Some words are better than others for quality, right? They point you at quality information. Now, where does Google really get these words? Well, they just take all the things they find on the web. And they make a list of the words they find in the best web pages, where they estimate what's good by how many people point to them. So they can figure out which words are associated with good content on the web. What if they gave you a list of words in books that have been selected by libraries as capturing a reasonably good cross-section of the best distillation of all human knowledge? Five major identifiers. Every book. What would you pay for those books? The price of the book. That's not good. So what are they actually doing? They're figuring out which word's a good word. Which, after all, is their business. Nothing Google has ever published. That's all. Why? Frankly, you can't even have that conversation without the last 10 weeks. I mean, so I asked you earlier today whether this class had changed your way you think about things. Many of you said yes. Here's the second question. How much of that change could have occurred through the same conversation if we skipped the last 10 weeks? If we hadn't talked at all about, for example, what a hard drive was, would any of that stuff about you saw when you looked at the page the decrease in price of hard drives than the increasing amount of stuff in the Internet Archive, right? I said, oh, no, yes, look at that, it's right there. Would you have been prepared to think about that without all that crunchy math homework? See, it really was good for you. That's why it's a question. Okay.
hear people posting on their blogs. And I should know people posting more than any other day nearby. Despite whether people are posting a lot more. When Geek Throat was revealed, this is the, what are more than ever previously. The Lemon Bombers, more than ever previously. So you can just use this as a sort of a volume control on the world. See, it used to be in the old days, newspapers would decide what was important and what wasn't. And you could measure what was in newspapers. Wait. Well, newspapers still mediate that. But you could also measure what people are talking about. These are people actually posting things. Now, of course, newspapers post things too. So you can compare them. But New York Times posts way more than any blog. And more than posts way more than today. So there are some laws that are starting to sort of intrude on the market. You can find those applause. At one point, back in 2001 or so, there was this axis of evil plot.
Remember the axis of evil that was Iran, Iraq, and North Korea?
Anyway, so what these people did at this broad search engine company, they're plotting the business they're in, they collect them, but the business they're in is tracking sentiment, the same thing Gibson did for his dissertation. So they're tracking how people feel, and of course, if you do that, how do people tell you how they feel? Really handy. You don't have to like call them on the phone, which is probably good because they don't talk on the phone anymore, right? Instead of the cell phone. It's getting really hard to survey people, but it's getting really easy to just watch them. So they got, you know, three lines, one for each of the three countries in the Axis. Anyway, but this one is a similar plot for Roberts, Rehnquist, and O'Connor. And you'll remember the story, maybe. Rehnquist dies, Roberts gets appointed, and O'Connor later resigns from the Supreme Court. Right? And so you can say, this is more popular, Rehnquist or Roberts, and it turns out it's more popular. You're more popular when you're dead, right? So naturally, Rehnquist gets all the press, but then there are confirmation hearings. Then Roberts gets talked about more than Rehnquist. And then O'Connor resigns and just barely edges out Roberts, who isn't doing very well against Rehnquist. Right? So you can sort of see what people are paying attention to. And of course, you can imagine people do this. They kind of call the happy words, they kind of call the upset words, and they, you know, they make a sort of a national smiley face or a national frown, maybe associated with different topics. It's like we're instrumenting the population.
Yeah. Google has a timeline feature for their news. If you go to news.google.com/archive, you can do a search and there's a timeline button and it does this.
Cool. Okay.
I just learned that today.
Here's the setup for next week. Is next week's search to give them an email? We got to do a search today. Search is real fast. Anybody know?
Search
it. Cool. Okay, this is the setup for next week. You've seen this column. This is the web in 1995. Take a look at this column. Speech takes a lot more space than the text does. It takes about, I don't remember the number, 20 times as many bytes to represent a word spoken as it does a word written. But disks have gotten way cheaper. So we can store 1.5 million spoken words for $1. Which means I can have a web of speech. I can store speech, you could download it. And I wouldn't care about the disk cost. Of course, I might care about the internet load, but probably not, because this is one-tenth of the U.S. population sending speech to one-tenth of the U.S. population at any given time without overloading the backbone. So Raspberry features an RSS, Sony features an RSS. This is why Skype works, by the way.
Right.
Skype is free because of that, though. The last mile actually isn't hard to speech because remember what we're trying to do? We're trying to cram text through a telephone before? That's what cell phones were made for. They were made for speech. So it's really not hard to get speech through the phone. Right? That's actually easier than they feel. And everybody's got and you'll remember the stellar number that we've gone from 5% to 10% to 20% of the computers could display content. The only reason 100% of the computers in the U.S. can't display speech is because their speakers aren't plugged in. Right? I mean, when was the last time you saw a computer that actually didn't have a speaker jack? I mean, they probably exist, but they're in museums. Okay. And where's the favorite page? It's possible to have lots of content on the web. There's the search engines at the time like us. And the thing that will make it possible to have lots of speech on the web will be the search engines. In fact, the search engines will incentivize the production and retention of stored digital speech. If you think back 50,000 years, human culture, as best people can tell, existed then. Anthropomorphically modern humans, behaviorally modern humans, with a language capability, people. But it wasn't until 5,000 years ago, give or take, we start to see the invention of writing. So for 45,000 years, this was a spoken culture. Everything we had was a spoken culture. And in fact, in those early days, writing was very strongly restricted. What's amazing about the modern era is how broadly the ability to read and write is shared. Right, so much of an advance in the last few hundred years, because there are so many people who can read and write. How many people can speak? How many people on the planet? 6 billion. How many of them older than 5? About 6 billion. How many of those can speak? About 6 billion. How many of them can write? A couple of billion. So still, there's some serious disadvantages to writing. It takes a long time to learn, particularly if you have to learn to write Chinese. Anybody here know how to write Chinese? So, how long did it take to learn?
It took me 4 years. And I learned like 700 years.
So they say it takes people 2 years longer to learn to write Chinese than it does to learn to write English, because English is all of that. So, if we could make a web of speech, it could be very empowering. All we'd have to do is connect the planet to the rest of the other systems, and they could use it. Speech is also good for some things that writing is bad for. And you should be quick to point out that writing is good for some things, but speech is bad for. Right? If you listen to an impassioned speech, me in classes, it's different from reading. So, if we solve this one problem, we will have a web of speech. Now, the reason why writing was so dominant in our society is that writing has three characteristics that speech must have. Writing has a degree of permanence. It's almost accidental how permanent it is. It's designed to keep traffic, business, like that originally. But it turns out that the media that people originally kind of had all lies. So writing carries information forward in time. Digital writing, on the other hand, is ephemeral. As soon as you turn off the computer and the lab, it's gone, the hard drive won't last. If you have been long, maybe a few years, and so then you might have to store it somewhere else, and then you'd have to copy. But if you could do that for digital writing, you could do it for digital speech. So digital speech is just as preservable as digital writing. It just costs more. But there's nothing that makes the digital writing any different. That doesn't make a difference. But how many people have one of these in their pocket?
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean the world. How many people have the instrument with which to write? A billion, right? Everybody who can write has some instrument with which they can write. How many people have the instrument for recording digital speech? A few. So the ability to acquire it is not markedly different anymore. In fact, having it really been markedly different since the advent of the invention. So the real advantage that writing has is that we can find a way. And if we manage to remove that advantage, then my claim is that this era in which writing was dominant will have been a short little 5,000-year snapshot in history. And that we'll go forward not with speech instead of writing, but with speech in addition to writing. We'll be able to do things with speech. And everything that we think of as civilization is in that 5,000. Which means that you can spend the rest of your career thinking about what to do with something that nobody before you has had available to them. If we can solve this one nasty little problem of how to search speech. So you asked me what I was doing in Tampa. We're spending over the last 3 years $150 million with a group of 1,000 people around the world for 3 years. We're in about the middle of the 5-year project. Okay, $150 million. We'll talk more about how we do that. But when I show you the demo, you're going to believe it will be there in your world. Oh, then you can tell within an hour I can touch it. Okay. Anybody want to guess what that list is? What's the web? Is it what's there, or how people react when they get there? This is how people react when they get there. You go find something on the web, what do you do? You pull a link to it, right? On the web page. Or you tag it. And you publish it. And that's just what people do to things on the web, it's just what people do with information. You can subscribe to a magazine, or you can purchase a single copy of a magazine, or you can bookmark a web page. So you can make lists of this. In fact, the first people who thought about this is called explicit feedback. You know, do something, you can either say, I like it, I hate it, or you can just act, and you can improve, not react, which is irritation.
The first thing they did was they made this list.
It's a great list.
But you can start to put some pressure on the list. They won't. What people really do? They can grab them things, they can remove things, they can refer to things, they can navigate things, they can create things. What are these things? They can be parts of things, they can be things, or they can be groups of things. But it's just a useful way of thinking about how your browser can spy out. If I wanted to correct all of this, what would I do? I build a browser and give it away for free, right? So this is how the public authorities work. People build links because they want to have people follow the links, but then we can use the links to say, well, here's a page that links to a lot of other pages, so it's a directory page. This page has a lot of pages linked to, so it's got some authority to it, lots of people refer to it. And here's a page that lots of people link to, and the people who point to it have some authority. They're not just anybody. They're not Joe the Sparrow, or on the web server, pointed to these pages. Nobody knows that. So this is the Google PageRank algorithm for figuring out which pages have higher quality and propagate this authority. And they do it based on observing people's behavior. The particular behavior is linking, and linking is very public behavior, so it doesn't raise a lot of privacy concerns. Here's a way that I could capture what you clicked on without running a search engine company. I could sell a service where web pages could instead of building links to other pages, they could build links to my service. And in the link, they could put the URL that you should ultimately go to. You link to me and I redirect you to the other service. You ever do this? You click on a link and it goes click, click, and you get a redirect? So they call the company DoubleClick. It does this. And what DoubleClick does is they put a cookie on your machine. And then they see every link that you go to a DoubleClick enabled site. And every click that you follow out of the DoubleClick enabled site. And they can make a graph of your browsing behavior without running a web search engine. At one point, DoubleClick tried to buy a credit card. Because, of course, the credit card company can see all the things you do in the physical world, and DoubleClick can see that in the virtual world. So, this would be a much better model of you if I could see both. And that blocked up. And so, recently, a search engine company bought DoubleClick. So, now they can see things that go on after you click. In fact, that's how the search engine knows where you clicked. Yeah.
How did they get the cookie on your computer?
How did they get it there?
Yeah, was it through another website or like?
Oh no, so they, your browser, if it's set up to accept cookies, DoubleClick provides the cookie service to the company. So the company gives them a website, they just add some DoubleClick stuff around it, which is a cookie header.
So there are websites that were not DoubleClick websites that people inadvertently got cookies.
Well, they're not, they don't say DoubleClick on the website.
Right.
But DoubleClick has DoubleClickized them. They took the content and built this redirected link content and gave it back to them and said, here, host this instead.
Okay.
And then DoubleClick shared revenue back to them. So this would be it. The European Union, what they want is to be illegal. So it's not illegal in the United States to give away information on people's browsing behavior. There's no law against it. There's no law against collecting it. There's no law against doing it right. What there is a law against in the United States is deceptive trade practices. So if as an inducement to use my website, you put up a policy that says we will not give away your data, and then later, you do give away my data, I could sue you for deceptive trade practices. Of course, it's very expensive to run those suits.
So what you want to do is form a government agency to run the suits on your behalf. They call it the Federal Trade Commission. And so that's how enforcement of privacy laws in the U.S. is done, is by enforcing privacy policy. How many of you have gone to your site, maybe Second Life, after a lesson in class, signed up, had the privacy policy displayed to you, and we're not waiting to scroll all the way to the end and hit OK? That's what you just agreed to. You just agreed to that policy being enforceable by the FTC. So the question is, how would anybody know what's in it? And should we pass a law that says we should explain it to you in English? That's the immigration policy question. Lots of fun questions. Okay, we'll see you next week when we do the most fun thing you have ever done before in your life. See how search engine works.
I'm